Hello, and welcome to the next episode of TransPerfect Lifestyle Talks. I'm Mark Wade. I'm the Global Practice Leader here at TransPerfect Life Sciences. Before we get into the podcast, let me just disclaim that the views and opinions expressed in the following podcast are that of the individual presenter and should not be attributed to their employer, the directors, officers, employees, volunteers, members, chapters, councils, committees, or affiliates, or any other organization which the presenter is employed or affiliated. Hi, and welcome to the next episode of TransPerfect Lifestyle Talks. I'm Mark Wade. I'm the practice leader here at TransPerfect. Today, I'm delighted to have Tom Wilgos, who is on the Patient-Centered Outcome Research Chapter at Roche Pharmaceuticals. Tom, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a pleasure. I'm kind of impressed today having you on this call because really, Roche, and to be honest with you, are at the vanguard of this. Yes, there are other people now talking about it, but you've been talking about it for quite some time. So I'm going to ask you, for the audience, could you explain what it is and why do we do it in the first place?
Yeah, thanks, Mark, and thanks for having me on. Firstly, I should say it's a very flattering thing to say, but it really is a community effort. And I think the really interesting thing is that patient experience data is an evolution in the terminology we're using rather than this completely new thing. So patient experience data encompasses all different types of patient insights and data that is generated with patients and about patients. So the FDA have very kindly moved this field forward quite rapidly and have a really nice definition of patient experience data. But for everyone who's listening who's not aware of it, it really captures all of the different types of insights that you might get as part of a clinical development program or even outside of that. So things like patient-reported outcomes, other clinical outcome assessments, they fit under that umbrella of patient experience data. Patient preference data also fits within that umbrella. But then you've also got other types of patient experience data that maybe traditionally wouldn't be seen under that same umbrella. So qualitative research, patient listening sessions, all the sort of qualitative interview type approaches, focus groups, but even stuff like observational studies, real world data, all of that could broadly fit under this umbrella. From a sort of patient-centered outcomes research perspective, we're really focused on understanding that patient experience and measuring it in the most appropriate way. So for most people working in this field, it does tend to boil down to understanding patient experiences and measurement of patient experiences. And that's roughly what you see in the public domain when people talk about patient experience data.
And this is very much on the FDA's mind. I mean, they briefed us recently about this, and there's a guideline, PFD, do you want to touch on that for one sec? Because again,
of course,
some of the audience might not know this. So,
the patient-focused drug development guidances have been issued over the past several years. I think for the last 3 or 4 years now, they've issued four guidances in total. And the way that it's nice to think of them is the kind of end-to-end process from understanding what's important to patients, what outcomes matter most, all the way through to developing and validating an endpoint in a clinical trial. So steps around, building conceptual models and conceptual frameworks for what to measure, as well as selecting the most appropriate outcome measure, validating those measures, even thinking about things like the meaningful change of that particular measure. They all are covered within those four guidances. So they're a really great resource for anyone who's interested in this space. Really well written, really comprehensive. And they build upon what was previously the FDA's guidance on patient-reported outcomes, which in itself was a really useful tool. I think over the time, we've realized that other types of clinical outcome assessments like performance outcomes or observer-reported outcomes or clinician-reported outcomes are also relevant. So the PFDD guidance really just addresses that and puts everything under this broader umbrella of clinical outcome assessments. So yeah, it's a great resource. As I say, for anyone who's interested, it's pretty much a how-to and all the things that you need to be considering to support endpoint selection in clinical trials.
We all know we want the patient as front and center and center in the study, but someone's got to pay for it. And there's got to be a reason to do it. So could you speak to any kind of ROIs or any, is there any ROI in this in real terms?
Yeah, it's a great question, Mark. And I think firstly, any research that isn't considering the patient at the heart of it, you know, is not good research. So there's a very, very strong ethical reason for doing this in the first place, a moral reason. And I think everyone I interact with in the industry feels very strongly about that. So this isn't something that's new per se. You know, we've always wanted to understand the patient experience. What has changed perhaps is the amount of value that different stakeholders place upon it. So, you know, in terms of medical research generally, we've moved past this, the physician knows best mentality into a much more patient-centered world where the patient perspective has weight and has importance. And in my experience, these guidances are really starting to address that in the real world. So you ask about return on investment. I mean, you could argue quite confidently that if you don't have a patient-centered endpoint in, as your primary endpoint in a trial, that's going to damage your opportunity to get a drug approval these days, right? It's become a really critical part of what we do. And when we say patient-centered, it doesn't necessarily have to be a patient-reported outcome. Of course, it could be progression-free survival. It could be overall survival. These are all patient-centered in some ways. Yeah. But what this has done, I think, is given us more confidence in selecting endpoints that we know matter to patients, and we know stakeholders care about those endpoints. So there is a really clear return on investment, I think, in terms of endpoint selection. Where it gets less clear, and maybe this is the challenge for all of us, is how those other types of patient experience data have value. And time will tell, I think, how that other type of data influences decisions and helps to get access for patients. And those are the areas where I think we're still kind of figuring things out.
Unpack that slightly, because some people, again, the audience will know a lot, but they might not know exactly what you're referring to.
So I think I'm talking here specifically around things like exploratory patient-reported outcome measures or things like exit interview data, where we're generating data that many would see as complementary to your kind of your key endpoints that would support a filing or would support access to new therapies. That's where the value, the return on investment is less clear, because we know that they have an impact in decision making, but there's very little evidence of that impact because they often don't appear in a product label. They often don't appear in the public documents around the review process. And understandably, stakeholders aren't talking openly about this being a must-have because it is a nice to have in some cases. So that's the area where I think we're all trying to get better at understanding the value. And of course, there are some really nice examples of where this does have value. But one of the things I'm really interested in is trying to put some numbers behind that. You know, what does this do in terms of our ability to get approval? What does this mean in terms of our ability to get access to more patients? Some of these less obvious types of patient experience data are where we need to focus our time and energy and really try to understand that better.
I suppose then the obvious question then is, if we all agree that there's huge payoff in doing this and it's important for good science, good patient data, where do we begin planning this? Where in the design phase do we begin this? To be honest, it's a little bit like language translation. I'm sorry, but it is, in that it's thought about later in the process and the boat's already started sailing. So where do we do this in the protocol study, in the study design part?
Yeah, I mean, without doubt, it's important to start early and have this built into, you know, exit interviews, for example, built into protocol designs from the very outset. I think the reality, unfortunately, is different, right? We're all working in a space where there is not unlimited time and money. And so there's a lot of influencing, I think, often that needs to go on to ensure that people understand the value of this type of data and we can build it into protocols. One of the things that's been really effective, I think, for many people in the industry is seeing the case studies of where doing this early and getting it as a core part of the protocol actually saves time and saves effort further down the line. Because just like your example of linguistic validation, when you're chasing your tail and you're trying to hit unrealistic deadlines, that's when things go wrong, or when you have to push things back because you can't achieve what you're trying to achieve. So there's definitely a clear benefit in including this type of data early on and planning accordingly. The reality often is very different. Sometimes people working in the industry will recognize we have a very short time to make a decision, or we're reacting to previous decisions that have been made. So it isn't always straightforward, but sure, where possible, you know, planning this from the outset, incorporating it into a protocol is of clear value.
And then once we execute, what do we do with that data? How do we treat it?
It's another great question. Again, I think this is an evolving space. So it depends on the intent of that data in the first place, right? You know, exit interviews, which is kind of what we focused on today, they can be used to do multiple different things. So for example, they could be used to better understand the treatment experience for a patient. They could be used to better understand, you know, the unmet need, symptom burden, most bothersome impacts of a particular disease. Or they could be used for some slightly more creative processes, which incidentally is what is referenced in the PFDD guidance, which is to support things like understanding meaningful change on a particular outcome measure. And for those who aren't really aware of that, we're talking here what amount of change would be meaningful for a patient. And so that's where the exit interviews can also have value. So we need to have a clear research question that this data is going to be addressing, and that will really dictate how we utilize that data. So sometimes it could be used as part of a broader filing package as an exploratory outcome measure, but sometimes it will be used in a complementary setting to support other decisions. So for example, I've seen examples of where it's been used to justify the selection of a particular outcome measure and an endpoint in a phase two study that then would support the use of that endpoint in a phase three program. I've also seen examples and heard of examples of where it's been used to support these meaningful change arguments that I just referenced. The intent of that data really will dictate how we use it in the long run.
That is fascinating. I've never heard that before, I've got to be honest. That is fascinating. I'm going to push back and say, the sponsors really have that time to do that? To uncover proof of concept, a different endpoint, even a secondary endpoint. Do sponsors traditionally have that time?
In many cases, they don't. I think in many cases, we are all trying to do the best that we can in a constrained environment. But there are occasions where you do have time to plan and you do have time to think, you know, what is the best trial design for this phase two program that will optimize our phase three program. Now, of course, the issue is that we're trying to answer multiple questions in a phase two study. And so this is just one of many. So it's not always possible, but there are definitely examples of where it can be successful. And where it's particularly valuable, of course, are in indications or diseases where there may not be clear endpoints or a clear precedent on what is acceptable. Often that's in the rare disease space, in the neuroscience space, where many of us are still trying to figure out what the best endpoints are. So in those cases, you know, the use of these data in the exploratory and the phase two space can be particularly impactful. I'm not going to be unrealistic and say that never happens. You know, there's frequently times when we're not able to do the gold standard, and it's about being pragmatic and trying to find the best way forward.
If we switch gears just slightly, because we're getting all this patient data from in-study interviews, but around 65%, if I'm right, 65% of studies today are executed overseas, outside in North America, right? I'm based in North America, so I'm going to say outside North America. So how do we... One, the regulators are super hot on diversity, and rightly so. But secondly, how do we handle this? How do we handle that diversity, and how do we handle all these different interviews and all these different geographies, all these different languages? I mean, it's man, does it get complex really quickly?
It is complex. It is absolutely complex. So I'm sitting in the UK and Europe, and you know, we're often talking about running clinical trials in multiple languages here in a pretty small geographic area. So I completely agree. It does get difficult. there is a really key question here around diversity and inclusion in our trials for these types of data, because historically there's probably been pressure to do this in the simplest way, right? So to do this in English-speaking countries only and to generate that data. I think we all recognize that that's not good enough and that we need to be generating these data in diverse populations. Yep. So we really have to plan early and we have to work hard to find, you know, the right companies that can support us with translation and actually even conducting those interviews in multiple languages. Very often these are done by third-party groups who specialize in this type of research. We're not asking study sites to do this themselves. And so there's a big infrastructure that goes on behind the scenes to enable us to be able to do this in multiple countries, in multiple languages, in multiple cultures. And it is a big challenge. I don't think there's a simple answer either, I have to say. You know, we have to do things in native language. We have to do things appropriately, and that requires investment. And to be truly inclusive, we do need to go above and beyond to actually generate that data. But again, these are the pressures I think that anyone working in clinical research will recognize, because they're universal, right? Whether you're conducting a trial in one country or 10 countries, the same questions come up. How are we inclusive? How do we make sure that we have the tools in the right native languages for the population, et cetera? So yeah, it's a challenge. It's a big challenge, but it's not a new challenge. And I think the industry is getting better at recognizing that and thinking ahead, again, to your point around planning, to make sure that we can do this in an inclusive way.
Is it possible to measure the impact on an NDA study, study drug? Is it possible to measure that impact with these interviews? Is it possible?
Great question.
It's a tough question. I know it's a tough one, isn't it?
It's probably not possible to do it accurately, but I think there are ways of kind of looking retrospectively and seeing how has this type of data influenced decision making. As I said, it's very difficult because we're not flies on the wall in all of these conversations, and you know we're not sitting in the seat of a reviewer, so it's hard to do. But I think as time goes on, as we build up this repository of use cases, we can start to build more confidence that this is valuable and is effective. Now, I know your question was around, you know, approvals. There's loads of other opportunities for these data to provide value, and I think that's something else we need to consider. There's been some great publications where exit interview data has been used to really broaden the research in a particular indication, right? To better understand the lived experiences of patients. And perhaps really importantly, it's being used to actually design better clinical trials in the future. There's some brilliant research out there where interviewers have spoken to, you know, sometimes thousands of patients who have been in clinical trials and have used that information to design better clinical trials in the future. So while, of course, I think this has value in optimizing approval of new therapies and in access to new therapies, I also think it has broader value in terms of designing better trials, being more patient-centric in the way that we engage patients in our clinical research. So, you know, obviously, I'm someone who's converted and very, very much an advocate for this, but I do think the value goes far beyond that kind of immediate use case of supporting an approval.
And when we're getting this, I'm going to call this ancillary data, just for want of a better word, ancillary data. When we're getting it, are we trying to get it in person, via phone, via Zoom? What is it? Because I'm pivoting to a DCT question. I just want to see where you land on this. Is this in person? Is this Zoom? Is this telephone? What is it?
Yeah, so I would say in the majority of cases, it is done remotely. In the majority of cases that I've experienced and that I've heard about, this is often done, you know, via a similar conversation to we're having today on the internet or via the phone. But there are examples where people would do it face-to-face. And I think it depends on the trial. It depends on the clinical sites. It depends on the type of research question that we're trying to ask. But, you know, more often than not, it is done remotely. And it relies on experienced interviewers who can actually, you know, set up those calls and really dig deep into some of these questions. So yeah, right. In that sense, it is decentralized already.
Yeah, because certainly, I mean, post-pandemic, the pandemic did the hockey stick for us for DCT. Suddenly everything was DCT. And it was wonderful. It was great. I wonder how do you feel about what I've noticed is that some sponsors are saying, slow down there, Turbo, slow down. Not everything's DCT, a hybrid model. And there is this pushback. Have you seen this as well? Or are you seeing this as DCT?
I think looking across the industry and speaking to colleagues in this space, there isn't perhaps the speed of moving to DCT that people expected. And when you think about it, you know, the initial drive for decentralized trials, as you say, was linked to the pandemic. It was a necessity driven approach rather than kind of a choice. Obviously that unveiled lots and lots of value in decentralized trials. And so sponsors and regulators have really started to talk about this in open settings. And I know the FDA also published a draft guidance on decentralized trials recently. Yep. But the reality is that as an industry, we probably weren't set up for this from the outset. So there is going to be this learning curve, this adjustment period where some of the new technologies that need to get invested in will need to be put into place. And that takes time and that takes energy, it takes money. So I do think there is a general kind of positive trend towards decentralized trials, and many people see the benefits. But what I hear from colleagues in the industry is it's not as simple as perhaps we would like it to be. We can't just flick a switch and suddenly we're doing this everywhere. Yeah. So I think that's possibly what's behind this hockey stick curve and the slight slowdown that you're observing.
And I totally agree. I was genuinely curious because those of us who are in clinical research, who came from clinical research, we appreciate the sheer complexity of what we're trying to do. And no disrespect to any of the ECOA vendors, but a lot of them come from a technology background and perhaps they don't realize the sheer complexity of what we're doing. So when the pandemic arrived, this is my two cents, and I'm probably going to get dragged for saying this, but when the pandemic came, as you say, out of necessity, and there was definitely a call to arms of everyone, we'll just flick the switch and that's it, and everything will be electronic. Paper is done, we're retiring paper. And there was this kind of like gung-ho, for want of a better phrase, attitude. So in a way, I think the recalculation, the reset button is quite a reasonable thing. My worry is that it goes too far because those people who don't want to go from paper to electronic now have an easy off ramp, that's my fear.
Yeah, it's a really good point. I think my personal opinion is that the technology has existed for quite some time for us to be able to do this. It's the infrastructure, it's the relationships with the sites, it's all of the other things that perhaps will take time to change and to catch up. And I think with anything technological that evolves over time, there's usually that lag where the tech is there, but the will or the infrastructure isn't. And certainly that's something that I've observed. But it's an interesting one because, most of the challenges that you observe are not down to the technology per se. They might be down to the implementation of that technology or, the operationalization of that technology, but it's not the tech that's necessarily the barrier.
I think it's very important to note that, and I hear this from sponsors, it's very important to note that tech has moved on. 15 years ago, we were using bespoke handheld devices. You remember this. We were using bespoke handheld devices. We were programming them. We were trying to get instruments on those devices. It was very heavy lifting. Today, we can support either Apple iOS or Android OSs quite readily. So the technology has moved on. So I think we have a responsibility, those of us who are in DCT, have a responsibility to explain that to people. It's not the same as 2004. It's we've moved on, boys and girls, like we have. But I think your point is right. It's not just about the technology. It's definitely the infrastructure process.
Yeah, and just one thing you've kind of sparked something in my head that I was thinking about recently. the speed of the technological advances has gone up as well, right, in recent years. I mean, it's rapid now how things are changing. I do wonder sometimes whether that speed of change makes people nervous to even kind of dip their toe in the water to some of these new technologies, because they fear, well, in a year's time, this is going to be out of date, and then what are we going to do? So yeah, there's this kind of this underlying, you know, speed of change that also maybe makes things more challenging, more difficult. I think the other thing, just on the topic of decentralized trials, is a lot of people talk about how it's an opportunity to be recruiting more diverse populations, to be more inclusive. And of course it is in some ways, because it allows us to get out into different geographies and to access different communities. But some would argue quite rightly that it also is a barrier to inclusion, because if people don't have, you know, the right technological skill set, or they don't have the right, you know, Wi-Fi internet connection, that can also be a challenge. So, you know, there's this kind of the will of the industry, and then there's the reality of what is happening in the real world. Sometimes they're maybe not entirely aligned.
I agree. And there's also that, don't forget, there's also the people, certainly in our industry, right? In our industry, we're not so great at change for the most part. We're not. I mean, we have to embrace that and admit that. So when we are presented with change, we have to kick the tires. We have to really get under the covers of it. And I think you're right. Because of technology has moved on so fast, it's almost like, whoa, slow. And there's this automatic reflex. Slow down. So, I mean, I think it's important for us to talk for us as an industry to talk about, like, the technology has moved on. Which shouldn't be something to be scared of. It's just an evolution.
It is. Yeah. Although I speak to people who have had negative experiences with technology in the past, and we could be talking the distant past, and that has been enough of a barrier to not want to go back into it. So there's also this kind of element of converting the naysayers, the ones that have had negative experiences. And to your point, the technology probably has moved on so much that it's not the same experience anymore. I guess that's just being human, right? Once bitten, twice shy, or whatever the phrase is. It's just a human reaction to things not going as you would like them to. So there's a huge amount of, I think, just influencing and demonstrating to people that it's okay. You know, the technology can do this in a way that we couldn't do in the past. So there's so many different variables at play here, and as a result, I don't think there's a simple solution. It's a case of us trying to kind of move forward in a pragmatic way, but be really transparent when things aren't working. And it's great to talk to you today. I think these types of conversations help to put that in the open.
I think so too. Tom, I really appreciate you joining us today. Today I was talking with Tom Wilgus. He's in the Patient Centered Outcome Research Chapter Group at Roche. Tom, thank you so much for today. And join us next time, the next episode of Transperfect Lifestyle Talks. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Mark.